CAO 2009 CA 2011. I see council are getting prepared for the first case. Council for the second case, please have a seat. And I see veteran counsel out there, so I don't think I have to go over all the rules of the Court of Appeals procedures, but let me know if I'm mistaken in any way, and I'll be happy to do so. Then the one thing that I would ask from everyone in the gallery is that if you have a cell phone or anything along those lines, that you please make sure that those are not operating or at least won't be going off during the arguments. And with that, we'll start with the first case. Thank you.
Express veteran is not being used as synonymous for old. My name is Scott Robinson. I represent David Zukowski on appeal, as I did at trial. My registration number is 6633. Some 11 years ago in People versus Janes, our Colorado Supreme Court threw out a conviction in a manslaughter case based on the use of what I call the good faith instruction. In Janes, a case that had already visited this court and was reversed by this court as well, the primary focus of both appellate courts was the burden of proof. I did not try the Janes case, I simply did the appeal, but what was the issue on appeal is whether the burden of proof had been shifted by the instructions. What we have in this case is a variation on that theme. Astonishing as it may seem to those of us who have dealt with the Make My Day statute at any length, it is still the practice of many prosecutors, as was the case in this situation, to tender an instruction not just as bad as the instruction in Janes, but in some ways worse. Because in People versus Janes, at issue was an instruction which essentially said that a good faith entry is not unlawful, essentially as a matter of law. But there was nothing in Janes about this knowing violation of the criminal law. That's an additional phrase that was tacked on to the instructions in this case, compounding the error that existed from the outset in the Janes case. Now, the Make My Day statute has had numerous appellate opinions arising out of its wake. And one of the seminal opinions is indeed People versus McNeese. In McNeese, authored by the court, was the language that is at issue here. Because in the course of deciding that an individual who had explicit permission to come into an apartment given to him by his own wife, Vivian, you had to have a trial. You couldn't throw it out on pretrial immunity because one of the essential elements of the Make My Day statute, which is the burden of the defendant to prove by a preponderance to get pretrial immunity, is that of an unlawful entry. And it was undisputed in McNeese that the decedent, the ultimate decedent, was invited into the apartment by a person who lived there who herself had a key. So in the course of sending the case back to the trial court, the Supreme Court wrote a lengthy opinion which included language about no immunity if a person enters accidentally or in good faith, and later referred to a knowing violation of the criminal law. Now that language was seized by the prosecutors in Janes and seized by the prosecutors in this case to distort the instructions to the advantage of the prosecution. Here, just as it was in Janes, good faith was never described. But unlike the Janes case, in which it just kind of was thrown out there, in this case, the prosecution exploited the language of good faith and exploited the language referring to a knowing violation of the criminal law from the testimony of both Detective Medina and of the listed victim, Andrew Holzgotter.
Mr. Robinson, I'd like to ask you about McNeese a little bit. Certainly in McNeese, the purpose of the opinion was to read a knowingly mental state into the elements of the good faith, the Make My Day statute.
A knowing element into the unlawful entry element, correct.
Right. And
in
so
in the specific context of pretrial immunity.
Exactly. And is your reading of McNeese that the fact that there was some sort of permission by someone who appeared to have control of the premises, that that made it actually a lawful entry?
Absolutely. That's what the Supreme Court was trying to communicate in its opinion to the trial court.
But they used some fairly broad language. They were talking about accidentally or in good faith. And so you think both of those terms modified the lawfulness or unlawfulness of that particular entry, or do you think that there was some sort of broader application?
I think it was limited to the terms of that particular case, although certainly the use of accidentally did not fit the facts in McNeese, and for that matter, didn't fit the facts in Janes and doesn't fit the facts here. I think the court is leaving open the possibility that an entry might be lawful if it's accidental. In other words, if somebody just strayed into somebody's house accidentally, then that might be an accidental entry. But that, of course, is not the issue here. So the focus here, I think, is good faith, and accidentally was not part of the added to jury instruction.
It does kind of drift away. The use of that language does, in a curious sort of way, drift away from the policy behind the Make My Day statute. Because, I mean, if someone drifts in accidentally, then they're not there for the purpose of committing crime.
I agree.
And it seems that that's a step that the Supreme Court didn't necessarily have to take in that opinion.
I agree. That's one word of many that I think were extraneous to the actual holding in the case. But of course, the real issue is, was it the intent of the Supreme Court in McNeese to authorize the splicing of appellate language from appellate opinions onto a statutorily prescribed defense? And that's the tinkering that I think requires reversal in this case.
Well, McNeese did use the knowing violation of the criminal law phrase, but I don't believe it used good faith in connection with the unlawful entry.
In what case?
In McNeese. They talked about good faith.
Absolutely.
But they didn't really talk about it in connection with an unlawful entry.
I think that's what they were talking about when they said there is no pretrial immunity. I'll paraphrase the sentence. There is no pretrial immunity if a person enters accidentally or in good faith. That one sentence has been what has been seized upon to create these, I'll call, hybrid instructions that we're hearing in James.
And so moving away from the good faith part, which I think we're on the same page on, the knowing violation, though, that language is in McNeese. So why is that not a correct statement of the law?
They're both in McNeese. The phrase good faith is in McNeese. What really the court is saying is that, at least in the context of pretrial immunity, we should imply a mens rea of knowingly. But that's not quite the same as instructing a jury that an entry has to be made in knowing violation of the criminal law, which created the kind of inappropriate situation we had here, in which a prosecutor argued that Holzgotter had to know, had to be practically certain, that he would get a ticket for trespassing, a specific criminal statute,
for
his good faith not to be overcome. And so that's why my position is that both good faith and the so-called knowing violation of criminal law were taken out of context from McNeese and thrown into an instruction where they do not belong, which gave the prosecution an unfair advantage. Now, I saw Judge Nieto, or heard him.
Yes, counsel. Is it your position that no instruction concerning a knowing unlawful entry should be used, or is it just the language used here that you're objecting to?
It's the language used here.
But some instruction on knowingly might have been appropriate?
I think it might have been. And in fact, as I was looking back through my notes, as the court may know, I tendered instruction from 18.4201. A person enters unlawfully when they, you know, don't have permission, non-invited. I know that doesn't relate to the Malczewski situation, but that wasn't an issue here. Perhaps that's where knowing unlawful entry could be construed. But the reality is that the way it was instructed, it permitted the jury to essentially discard the Make My Day statute if Holzgotter didn't himself have a picture of a particular statute he was violating.
And that was the argument that was made?
That's just not the law. That argument was specifically made. He was practically certain to be ticketed for trespassing, which is a gross distortion of the Make My Day statute. I don't know which is worse, knowing violation of criminal law, which creates that sort of distortion, or telling the jury that good faith is somehow an issue, because as I went into great detail, perhaps too much in the brief, there are over 800 references to good faith in our statutes, and they're very, very different. We're basically assuming that the jury would know what good faith meant. But my problem is, even knowing what good faith meant, at no place in McNeese did the Supreme Court give even the slightest indication that they intended that language, perhaps loosely used, to become the jury instruction, essentially the pattern jury instruction. And here we are 11 years later, it's still there.
Counsel, was the definition of good faith ever discussed? And once you realized that you were going to lose on the instruction that you had fought about, did you offer a definition of good faith at that point?
I personally did not offer a definition. My position at trial and on appeal is that it is too vague to be defined in the context of this case. As I explained to the court, good faith is troublesome. The court herself said, I'm bothered by the ambiguity of it, which is why at one point she encouraged the prosecution to permit defense counsel to use the limited scope of invitation instruction, because she felt, for reasons I don't completely understand, that that would ameliorate some of the problems. The prosecution's position was that if we tried to define good faith, we'd have instructions that were 150 pages long. They might have been right, because in the context of jury instructions on the Make My Day statute, the concept of good faith or lack of good faith is alien. It belongs only in a discussion of pretrial immunity, which this court held in its opinion in James, which the Colorado Supreme Court held in its position in James, in its opinion in James. Now, I note I have been yellowed. Are there other questions, or may I save my remaining time? Thank you. How much time do I have?
3 minutes and 58 seconds.
Thank you, and may it please the court, John Lee on behalf of the people, bar number 38141. Twice the state Supreme Court has addressed the issue of what the term unlawful entry means in the context of the Make My Day statute. And twice the Supreme Court has articulated that the term means an entry in knowing violation of the criminal law. Because a good faith entry is simply the flip side of saying that the entry was not made in knowing violation of the criminal law, our position is straightforward. It was a correct statement of the law, and the court did not abuse discretion. The crux of the defendant's argument today, I think is, or at least as I understand it, is that although this was a principle articulated by the court in McNeese, there was nothing in McNeese suggesting that it should apply outside of the pretrial immunity. In doing so, I think the defendant's trying to mint a never-before-recognized distinction between the elements of the pretrial immunity and the Make My Day defense. There's no such distinction. How do we know? Jane says so. In the case that followed McNeese, the Supreme Court explicitly said that only the burden changes. The elements between pretrial immunity and the affirmative defense do not change.
The existence of the good faith language that wasn't really addressed in Jane's, it was just the burden. Is that correct?
I would say that was the most important part of, that was the most salient issue in the case. The language was written, though, it expressly said that the elements do not change.
Right, but I mean, it had the good faith language, which was in the instruction in that case, but the court really didn't give a stamp of approval in Jane's to the good faith language, did it?
I would say it did, in the sense that it did give a stamp of approval of an entry has to be made in knowing violation of the criminal law, which I would submit good faith is saying the exact same thing. By saying that someone entered in good faith, you're saying they did not enter in knowing violation of the criminal law.
Is that really what good faith says? Good faith as to what? Good faith as to the scope of an invitation? Good faith as to the legality of it? Good faith as to what?
Good faith as to the entry, which I think would answer all those things, that you entered in good faith, not knowing that you're violating the criminal.
Would that be a defense to a criminal charge of trespass that, oh, I thought I had permission, oh, I thought it was okay?
Absolutely it would be. I think the court went to great
length. A defense in law, not a defense in fact.
Oh, it would be a defense in fact, Your Honor. You're correct. But I think if we look at McNeese...
Why are we including it in a statement of the law?
Because it's what the General Assembly intended to do. In creating, and McNeese says this in great detail, that they wanted to make sure that the defense only applied to a category of people who entered, who were knowingly entering in violation of the criminal law.
Mr. Lee, let me ask you about this. McNeese does require an actual unlawful entry, correct?
Yes.
Okay, now, usually uninvited means unlawful, unless you have a situation with the police officer, which we don't have here. What if you have a person who knows that their entry is uninvited, but they have some sort of a reasonable good faith belief in their authority to go inside? For example, like let's say someone had heard this concept, citizen's arrest, and they understood that they weren't invited to come in, but they thought that they had some sort of right to go in and make a citizen's arrest. Would the court's language in this instruction be broad enough to cover that situation? Well, first of all, let me ask you, is that situation okay under the Make My Day? Would that be a lawful or unlawful entry?
I think on those facts presented, it would be a lawful entry.
If someone just thought that they had a right to make a citizen's arrest and they went in, you said your position is that that's a lawful entry?
If the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that yes, that the person entered in good faith, not in knowing violation of the criminal law, yes, it would be. And I think, and to maybe provide a little more color to that answer, looking at McNeese, the opinion went to great detail to explain what would satisfy the unlawful entry. And in doing so, they talk about unknowingly unlawful crimes in Colorado, all of which require a knowing mental state. Burglary, first-degree burglary, second-degree burglary, first-degree trespass, second-degree trespass. All of those crimes require a knowing entry in violation. If you enter in good faith, you're not knowingly entering. You don't have the same mental state. I mean, that vitiates the element. A good example of that point, in preparing for argument, I think is one of the cases that the defendant principally relies upon. And I think it's on page 21 of his opening brief, and that's People v. Riley, a 1985 Supreme Court case. In that case, the court gave the jury an instruction saying, it was a securities fraud case, that it's not a defense if you find that the defendant acted in good faith if so long as his disclosure was fraudulent. On review, the Supreme Court said because of willful, which was the element in that case, is tantamount to knowing. By doing that, the court gave the jury two instructions that were at complete odds with one another. By saying that by doing something in good faith, you're not knowingly deceiving. And I think that absolutely applies to the context here. By entering good faith, you're not knowingly violating the criminal law. It's disproving that element. So in that context, I think the instruction here was absolutely proper and completely endorsed both by the language of McNeese and in James.
Generally, though, a mistake of fact will be sufficient, but a mistake of law isn't a defense to a crime that's an entry. And so in your situation, are you arguing that under the structure of the Make My Day statute that it can be either a mistake of fact or a mistake of law, but either one suffices to make the entry lawful?
Do you have an example of one?
Well,
I think it would depend on the facts. It's hard to imagine one would be one and not the other.
Yeah, I think a mistake of fact might be the situation in McNeese itself, where you're confused that the owner of the premises, someone who appears to be the owner, lets you in, when in fact they have no authority. That would probably be a mistake of fact, I'm thinking. But a mistake of law might be if you think that you have some legal right to go in someone's house, but you actually don't.
Okay. Clearly, the mistake of law would not be enough. I mean, that's clear enough in Mokowski. I think the mistake of fact, yes. I don't think that the statute was intended to cover it.
By just using the broad term good faith, though, doesn't this instruction allow the jury to consider either a mistake of fact or a mistake of law as to the entry? Wouldn't that instruction be broad enough to allow the jury to assume either one would suffice?
I think if we look at how the instruction was tendered as a whole, that wouldn't have been the case. The part with the good faith was immediately following and preceding the rest of the statement that the knowing violation of criminal law. I mean, good faith was tendered in that context. So I don't think the jury could have read in a way where it would have thought that there were two separate elements. That if the defendant was knowingly, or let me rephrase. What I think it was correct is if the way the jury could interpret it, if the victim was in good faith, not entering illegally, then the defendant was not entitled to the Make My Day defense, which I think is an absolute correct instruction of law. I don't see how, in your example, the mistake of fact versus mistake of law, there could be two different instances. Because in order for the jury to find it as instructed, it would have been a mistake of law. Or a mistake of fact, I'm sorry.
I'm curious about one more thing. How does this tie in with the public policy behind Make My Day? Because if we read the statute that broadly, then how does the person who's in their home, when someone comes in, how do they know whether the entry is in good faith or not? Now, I know to a certain extent McNeese allows that view too, but I'm just curious as to how you think that relates.
I think it absolutely squares with the legislative history. I think it's important to remember that when they passed the Make My Day statute, it was largely prophylactic. The purpose was to create a rule that would stop people from entering at the first place. It wasn't a rule passed that once you enter, you're pretty much beholden to whatever the homeowner wants to do. And the Meek course makes that very clear, citing the legislative history that supports that point of view. That really what it is trying to strike a balance between a homeowner's right to protect themselves by creating this prophylactic rule while also not encouraging casual killings. The fact that someone might just enter your apartment, we don't want to give homeowners incentive that just go ahead and take your chances and shoot them and hope you can get off later. They wanted to create that strict balance, and I think that's clear in the legislative history.
So I have a question about the initial aggressor.
Yes.
What evidence is there in the record that indicates that the defendant was the initial aggressor in this case?
I think all of the evidence indicated he's the initial aggressor. I first point to the victim's testimony that when he entered the apartment, the defendant just started hacking away at him. I would also.
But at that point, he's in his own property, right?
He is.
Yes, so they've sort of crossed the threshold and they've gone into the home. Is that what you're relying on as the initial aggressor?
Well, I think we're dealing with two very different defenses. Self-defense and Make My Day are separate and they don't conflate and create the same elements. So with self-defense, I don't think we look at, it would have been a jury question whether the threshold was an aggressive move making the defendant or making the victim the initial aggressor, but it certainly would not be the case as a matter of law that by crossing the threshold automatically, he's the initial aggressor. They are separate defenses. Also, I point to the evidence, I think, in the defendant's testimony, his own testimony, where he said that he wasn't sure whether, like, he hit the victim twice, perhaps before. I mean, he was very candid with what he remembered of the incident and testified that it was entirely possible that he hit the victim twice before the victim ever hit him. I think based on that evidence, surely it was a jury question to decide who was the initial aggressor.
So you're not relying on the earlier sequence of events where the defendant goes into the condo of the victim and once or twice and then is chased from there to his own condo. That's not part of your analysis of what would make him the initial aggressor.
I think that could be a basis for the jury to infer. I just think the other evidence is stronger. The fact that the defendant was the person who initiated the physical contact. I think in the reply brief, defendant argues that as a matter of law, the victim was initial aggressor through the eloquent expression of his body language, but I don't think that's the law. Certainly here the evidence was in dispute as to who was initial aggressor, and as such, the trial court properly left that matter for the jury.
As he withdraws from the condo and is fleeing to his own, which is why I was asking if you're using that time, that sequence of events as a part of the evidence of him being the initial aggressor, it seems to me that at that point he's clearly leaving and it's undisputed that he's fleeing and he's leaving to his own condo. Do you still believe that there's something that would support that being evidence of him being the initial aggressor during that time period?
I guess under that framework you wouldn't have to, but I guess the point of my argument was under the victim's testimony, he enters with no bad intentions to the victim's apartment or to the defendant's apartment. The defendant then starts immediately hacking at the victim. Certainly based on that evidence, the jury could have inferred that the defendant was the initial aggressor. I mean, again, even under his own testimony, he is the one, or he could have been the one, that initiated the physical contact. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask you to affirm the judgment of the court below. Thank you.
I think the distinction between a mistake of law and a mistake of fact is important in this case, but I think the real essence of the problem with a good faith instruction is it gave the jury literally no guidance as to what it was good faith to, which is what Judge Nieto was asking about. I mean, the combination of those two inquiries, I think, illustrates one of the problems. The jury was never told what good faith related to, what it meant. In the context of a case in which an individual came to court, obviously from the record and from the photos, scarred, a nice-looking young man, all the jury had to decide is that he meant well. And that's something, of course, I mentioned in the brief. That's not what the good faith language was used to imply in McNeese, and it's certainly not what the legislature intended when they passed the Make My Day statute. As I indicated earlier, I see this as a situation, aside from the burden of proof, worse than the instruction in James, because at least in James, all we were dealing with was good faith. Here, we're dealing with this loose language of a knowing violation of the criminal law, which itself opened itself up to a legitimate argument, albeit not within the ambit of what the Make My Day statute was intended. But the prosecution, once they got that instruction, was free to argue that poor Andrew Holzgotter didn't know that there might be a statute on trespassing that he could be ticketed for. In fact, he had to be practically certain, because of the knowing aspect of it, that he would get a ticket for trespassing if he went into condo unit number 209. The combination of those two aspects of this instruction deprived David Zukowski a fair trial. And in light of how easy it would have been to give it a proper instruction, in light of the language in James, I think it was just utterly inappropriate. There was a question also about initial aggressor. My position is simple. Once Andrew Holzgotter comes into David Zukowski's condominium, at this point, Zukowski is scared to death. It is Holzgotter coming towards him that is the initial aggressor. It is not Zukowski coming towards him. And the photo of the bit of scalp on the kitchen floor is very important in this case, because it really impeaches the credibility of Holzgotter as to where, in fact, he was hit. So it's it's very important, of course, to me, because I'm hoping to retry the case, that we get the initial aggressor instruction right, assuming the testimony is the same on retrial as it was in the first trial, which leads me a minute to throw in my 2 cents worth about apparent necessity. I realize this court cannot overrule Hare and Beckett, but this case illustrates so completely why it isn't enough to say, as the Hare and Beckett majority said, that the concept of apparent necessity, the right to act on appearances, is incorporated in our self-defense statute. Because the minute I started talking about it to the jury, prosecution objected, and the judge's response was, it's argument. So in one swell swoop, as I like to say, what is a century-old concept of the right to act on appearances is eliminated for all practical purposes. And I mention it here not because this court can do anything about it, but because it illustrates, in this particular case, the position of David Zukowski. Because to him, a very scary-looking, very strong, very drunk man was coming into his home to hurt him. Any questions about any of the issues? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. We'll now set up for the second case this afternoon, and that's McGee versus ICAO.